Today's December 7th, and something happened on December 7th, 1941. Anybody remember? Pearl Harbor, yeah. The Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor and killed 2,400 American service members and civilians, and then declared war on the United States. It was in that order, too, actually. And this is when World War II truly became a world war. Before December 17th, World War II was made up of two large regional conflicts, one centered in Europe and North Africa, and the other centered in China. After December 7th, it really was World War II. And in Canada, we tend to compare all wars to the two world wars, World War II and World War I. In some ways, World War I had a bigger impact on our country than World War II, interestingly. But the sheer size of World War II is the measuring rod of war today. And that's because of the huge amount of physical damage done throughout the whole world. Japan, Germany, Soviet Union, Britain, Italy, untold places in China, the Philippines. I mean, it's just everywhere. And it's also because that approximately 60 to 85 million people were killed in World War II. That number keeps going up as we start thinking it through. About 50 million civilians and about 25 million military personnel died in World War II. People from all over the world, North America, Europe, India, Japan, China, many places. And there hasn't been a magnitude of war like that since 1945. If not for the world, not for Canada, not Korea, not Vietnam, not the two Gulf Wars, not Afghanistan. Nothing compares at all. You know, the Gaza War has been in the news lately, the war between the Israelis and Hamas, and the death toll stands at approximately 70,000 people. But of course, that number comes from the Gaza Health Ministry, which itself is run by Hamas, so we know the first casualty in war is always the truth, right? That quote goes back to a Greek playwright named Aeschylus in the 5th century BC. So people have known this future of war for a long time, 2,500 years. The first casualty in war is truth. So especially when there are good propagandist reasons to exaggerate, we should be on guard. But nonetheless, tens of thousands of people have died in Gaza in the war. And when you look at all the infrastructure damage on top of the death total, there's a true catastrophe going on in Gaza. But when you compare the Gaza War to what was happening in Stalingrad in 1942 and 1943, where 1.2 million people died, it makes Gaza smaller in its scope. There's lots of destruction and death in Gaza, but it doesn't compare to what happened in Stalingrad in 1942, 1943. And as far as current wars go, Gaza is just one of many regional wars. Most of these regional wars we never even hear about over here in Canada. They're regional in nature. They don't have worldwide scope, so we don't really pay much attention to them. Of course, the one war that we do hear about quite a bit is the war in Ukraine. And the Ukraine war dwarfs, I think, all other wars going on at the moment. The latest casualty report I've heard is that 500,000 Russians have died over the last 4 years. 500,000 Russians have died. Maybe 150,000, 200,000 Ukrainians, too. Cities destroyed, infrastructure ruined, societies hugely disrupted, especially Ukrainian society. But there's a civil war going on in the Sudan at this very moment between two factions of the Sudanese military. And the number of deaths that have occurred over the last couple of years is coming close to 150,000 people. And that doesn't include all the ancillary deaths that come from malnutrition and disease that accompanies war, too. And then there's a cascading series of civil wars in Ethiopia over the past decade. We actually have an Ethiopian family that we're supporting here as refugees at Trillium. They fled one of these cascading series of civil wars going on in Ethiopia. And that civil war, those series of civil wars have taken the lives of a million people. A million people. And there's talk today. I heard the president of Ethiopia talking about the fact that they're going to invade Eritrea to get a blue water port, because Ethiopia is cut off from the sea, and they want a blue water port, so it seems the struggle is just going to replicate itself again. And then there's been this nasty war going on in the Democratic Republic of Congo for the past 20 years, at least 20 years. We have another refugee family, the Makilas, that we've supported over the last 10 years or so, who have fled the DRC to get over to Canada to a safe place. And tens of thousands of people have died in the last year in the DRC. And probably over a million people have died over the last 20 or 30 years there. Even the genocide in Rwanda is connected to the struggle that's going on in Central Africa today. And then I saw a news report that the Pakistanis and the Taliban are on the verge of a major war together. The conflict's been escalating on the borders between Pakistan and Afghanistan, and it's going to lead to war. It's what's being predicted. 20,000 people died in 2024 from civil strife in northwest Africa caused by militant Islamists trying to gain power there. 11,000 people died in Mexico in 2024 from the ongoing drug war. The battles between law enforcement and the drug cartels, but especially amongst the drug cartels themselves, 11,000 people died from the struggle going on in Mexico. 140,000 people have died in the past 20 years there through the drug wars. And I could keep going. There are lots of places in the world that are simmering at the moment, but who could explode open at any moment. Like the whole situation in Syria could re-erupt again into a major civil war. The government's teetering on falling today. The war in Yemen, the civil war in Yemen, is about to break open again too. Haiti always seems to be on the verge of blowing up. 20,000 people died in Myanmar last year through a civil war that's going on there and ethnic cleansing. Now, these might not be World War II level numbers, but these deaths still represent a huge local impact, and they represent real lives of real people. 8 million people have fled Venezuela over the last 10 years. That's one quarter of the population that's fled the country because of the Maduro government. When you look at the big picture going on in the world, it is somewhat fascinating to me that the war in Gaza takes up so much oxygen. It's not that what's happening in Gaza is not important. There's just so many other situations going on in the world. And yet I see no protests for the civil war that's going on in Sudan or in Ethiopia or the struggles going on in Myanmar or even the war in Ukraine. I don't see people protesting. And I wonder why. War and conflict are not new. Violence and strife have been a feature of human existence from the very beginning. And our time is really not different than the past, except maybe the means have gotten greater and the scope is worldwide today. Because what happens around the world touches us here, directly and indirectly. The Bible sees war and conflict as another feature of our desire to go it alone. It's another consequence of us firing God and putting our lives under our own management. See, because once we depose God as our authority, the question then becomes, who is going to be our authority in our lives? That's the next question that needs to be answered. Well, then who is my authority today? And usually for most of us as individuals, we make ourselves our own authority. We put our lives under our own management. But the same question belongs to our communal connections with each other. Once we depose God, who is the authority in a tribe or in a peoples or in a nation? What happens when two persons, two tribes, or two nations want the same thing? When they want the same land, when they want the same resources, when they want the same access, when they want the same security? Well, we know the answer to that question or those questions. What happens when people want the same thing? There's usually conflict, violence, war. Sally and I were vacationing in the upper Michigan State in the Northern Peninsula. And we came across this interesting historical plaque. It's called the Place of Iroquois Bones. I think it's the second, there it is right there. It's a plaque up there. It commemorates a major battle in 1662 between the Ojibwe and the Iroquois. The name of the battle gives you a certain picture of what happened. Who won, the Ojibwe or the Iroquois? Who do you think? Sorry, I didn't. The Ojibwe, yeah, because it's the Iroquois bones that lie there, right? This is the place of the Iroquois bones. This is where the Ojibwe crushed the Iroquois invaders, and it ended the westward expansion of the Iroquois. And when I saw this plaque, I was surprised because I had no idea the Iroquois were that far north. We're talking about the south shore of Lake Superior. I had no idea that they had gone that far west either. It was obvious that there were two major native tribes who wanted the same lands and resources, and both were ready to battle for it. Think about the UN partition plan of Palestine in 1947. I got another map there. There it is. The UN tried to create a just settlement for both Arabs and Jews. Now, some people dispute that. They say it's not a just settlement. But for me, I just look at that map. It's a convoluted mess. And it seems to me that there was a real attempt to try to meet both sides' needs in this imperfect solution. And it was imperfect. It had many, many faults, this plan. There were considerable historical arguments from both sides that would have justified vetoing this partition plan. No one was happy with the proposal. Still, one might hope for enlightened self-interest to prevail because, like in so many other cases, when there are overlapping claims, the alternative is often war. And war is ugly and vicious. And there are good reasons, really good reasons, to try and avoid it, if possible. Seek an amicable settlement. That's a noble undertaking in the face of the alternative, which is war. In 1940, one side, the Jews, said yes to the partition plan. And it's possible that the Jews only said yes because it was part of a longer-term strategy for later expansion. Who really knows? It might have been. And the other side, the Arabs, said no. And I've listened to the Arab point of view on this, and they have a good argument to make for why they shouldn't have had to compromise in 1947. But the question isn't necessarily whether one side has the better argument. The question is whether one's argument is better than war. Is what you are seeking worth the risk of war? Is what you seek what war can bring? And maybe sometimes the answer is yes. I'm not a pacifist. Probably most of you aren't either. There are times when we need to draw a line. There are times when we need to defend a point, be prepared to defend that point. That happened in World War II. We supported the line that the French and the British drew around Poland. And when Germany crossed that line, Canada entered into World War II. And I think it was essential that Nazi Germany be taken down. It was an evil regime. There's no doubt about that. But when we agree to fight that kind of war, it becomes ultimately an all or nothing proposition. And in that scenario, winning becomes everything. And it's amazing what people will do when winning becomes everything. And when both sides play for keeps, it's a super, super serious matter. The Middle East has always been a tough neighborhood. It's tough today. It was tough 100 years ago when Isaiah wrote his vision for us. In Isaiah chapter 9. You didn't survive very long in that part of the world. You don't today, and you didn't 2,500 years ago. You had to have a certain toughness about you. You had to have a certain resilience about you. You could not show weakness to the other. And Israel was right in the middle of it, literally right dab in the middle of this tough world. And whether today or yesterday or thousands of years ago, this eat or be eaten world starts to wear on you, even on the toughest people. Is this the best we could do as human beings? Really? Is this the best we could do? Eat or be eaten? Israel wondered about this a long time ago. Is the eat or be eaten world the best we can do? Really? And a divine vision comes to Isaiah. He sees a people who are walking in darkness, a battered, a bereft, and anguished people, a people stumbling about in the darkness, not knowing whether they are coming or going, buffeted around by life. And they see a great light. A light has dawned upon them, and their joy has been awakened in them. And they rejoice as people rejoice in the bounteousness of a great harvest, a time of overflowing abundance. It's as if in this moment the weight of the world has been taken off their shoulders. It's as if in this moment the grind of life that we all know has stepped aside from them. The pressure of one's burden temporarily evaporated. You see, in Isaiah's vision, the time of war is over. How do we know this? Well, because the accoutrements of war are no longer needed. The warrior's boots and the garments stained in blood, they are destined for burning. Their only purpose to be fuel for the fire. You know, today's U.S. defense budget is over $1 trillion. China's defense budget is roughly $600 billion. The world's total defense spending in 2025 tops $3 trillion. In Isaiah's vision, he imagines the whole structure of the world that supports this kind of military spending comes tumbling down. It's over. Why? For to us a child is born. To us a son is given. And the government of the world will be on his shoulders. And he will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. He will reign on David's throne, and the greatness of his government and his peace, there will be no end. From the moment he assumes power, he will establish justice and righteousness in the world forever. And he will do this because God is with him, totally, completely, without limit. For Isaiah, this was a vision, a powerful vision that sustained people's hope for tomorrow. For us who live today, for us who have gathered here at Trillium, who feel the weight of the world on our shoulders, many of us, we believe this child has already been born. To humble parents, in a small village in the backwaters of Judea, do not be misled by his humble origins. He has come to overthrow the default pattern of this world, a world that needs today to spend $3 trillion on defense, or maybe $3 trillion on war. He has come to turn the world back to what God had created it to be. He is truly Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Emissary of the Everlasting Father, and Prince of Peace. Do you know his name? Do you know his name? What is his name? Pardon? I know you know it. Jesus, yeah, it's Jesus. More importantly, will you follow him? I mean, you've partaken of the sacrament of Holy Communion, but will you follow him? Will you make his pattern your pattern today? Will you allow his vision for life to become your vision for life? If you do, he will give you a peace that passes the understanding of this world. See, the world does not know him, so it cannot know his peace. But you who follow him and make his pattern your pattern in life, by default, know who he is. And therefore, you can know his peace. And while we wait for Jesus to return, to consummate what he started, to complete what was begun in him, while we wait in these days in between, we live in the knowledge of his presence. And we welcome his peace into our minds, into our bodies, and into our lives. A peace that transcends the understanding of this world that walks in darkness. In fact, we who have gathered here at Trillium, we commit ourselves today as a testimony of our obedience to the will of God in Jesus Christ and in complete trust in the promises of God to awaken that Christ light in each other and shine it in the world. So let the Christ light awaken in you. Stop hindering it. It wants to shine in you. It really does want to shine in you. So let it shine in you. Get out of its way and let it shine. And maybe, just maybe, the people who walk in darkness in our times will see a great light shining through you and me. And they will turn to the light. And they too will rejoice as people rejoice in the midst of a plenteous harvest and in the time of overflowing abundance.